6th, and we are starting late because floor session went over today. We had a great debate, and so it's now 1:45. And I want... Pardon me?
Nothing.
I want... Because we need to vacate this room promptly at 2:50, I'm going to ask for some full discussion, but if we need to make changes in the agenda, please don't hesitate to give recommendation. Any committee members, make sure we hear that issues completely and comprehensively. But with that, make sure your cell phones are off. And I'm going to open a public hearing on both House Bill 2615 and House Bill 2614. And we're going to start our testimony for somebody that's been long awaiting time to speak, and that's John. And John, if you introduce and say your last name correctly so I won't mess it up.
John Tapponia.
Okay, and Sue, if you'd also introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Sue Hildick, and I'm the president of the Chalkboard Project, and thank you for having us back today. So we want to talk about House Bill 2615, which is our finance bill, and the concept is to create a per-student spending guarantee. And John is a member of our working group that we had on this topic that you heard last week. Jim Scherzinger chaired for us, and Duncan Wise was here last week. He couldn't come back today, but three members, three different perspectives on the issue. And I just want to remind you before John lays out how the bill works that this works in concert with two other pieces, a doubling of the stability fund, which we think is critical. And for our purposes, we like the idea of dedicating the corporate kicker to that fund to get it as full as possible, as quickly as possible. The other thing I wanted to do before John lays out specifics is just comment a bit on how Chalkboard connects to the QEM, because that's come up before in some of the other testimony you've heard, and I think it's relevant to this conversation. And what you need to know first off is that we use the QEM heavily in our work, and we looked at it very carefully, and what we view our package of proposals as an implementation plan for the QEM. We believe that what we're proposing is that you invest in the most validated parts of that plan. And we were encouraged that recently the Quality Education Commission just issued their 2006 report, and for the first time they prioritized how you could implement the QEM, which we were very excited to see. That was something we had asked them to do along with others. And what they said is really there are two key constraints to fully implementing it. First, that it's unlikely that school districts have the capacity to effectively implement the QEM all at once. And secondly, that the large increase in funding the full QEM would that the large increase of funding that's required would be very difficult to achieve in a single biennium given the state's revenue structure. So they proposed two alternative strategies, either a 10-year phase-in or establishing goals based on the most promising practices. And I have a copy of their one page about these alternatives, which we'll hand out. What we're presenting is alternative two, the strategy that would devote state resources to those areas most promising to move student achievement statewide. And the QEC came very close to the same recommendations that Chalkboard has. They suggest that we invest in reading in the early grades and providing training to educators and skill development for teachers and principals. And that coincides almost to the letter of Chalkboard's plan, two separate independent processes coming to almost the same conclusions. The QEC goes on to add that piloting high school reforms would be the next step. That's a step that we delay in our plan. But I think it's important to note that we're very much on the same page. And the other point we want to clarify as we head into this conversation is what we have said about educational research. I think you've heard a lot of different perceptions of what we've said. And I'm very glad to be sitting here with our research guru coordinator who has helped us really dig through what's been available statewide and what's available nationally and internationally. What we are saying is that there are very few gold standards. That doesn't mean there's not a lot of promising practices, a lot of innovations going on, and we're looking at those and watching those. There are very few that sort of rise to that level of validation, and that's what John's going to clarify for you today. I do want you to know we're well aware of the work of the University of Oregon, and in fact, David Connolly was a member of our research team. He's done a lot of the work that we're presenting to you. And in fact, David was the person who came to Chalkboard and asked us to establish a research center for the state of Oregon, which is something our foundations are thinking about. So I should also mention that all of our research has been peer-reviewed by Oregon and national experts quite thoroughly. That was really important to us. So John can comment further on that.
All right. Again, for the record, I'm John Taponia, Managing Director, Echo Northwest. To Sue's point, the distinction on research is there is a large body of educational research. Graduate schools of education put out a lot of that. And in recent years, again, as I testified a couple of weeks ago, there has been a real focus on what parts of that research have been conducted through experimental designs that truly allow you to isolate a practice or maybe a limited set of practices and a link to achievement gains. And it's expensive type of research to do. It's too rare, in my view, in the education area and in social policy generally. But there is some out there. Tennessee Star is a prominent example. The randomized controlled experiments around the SMART program as well have come out of Oregon and have risen. Going into the social policy area in the Portland area, the jobs program that was run by Portland Community College in the 90s, also at that level. I was going to enter into the record this document from the Department of Education released in December of 2003. You don't have copies of it, but I brought one today, and we'll leave it here. In collaboration with a group called the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, kicked off in 2003 an effort to really identify what research stands above the others. And in the executive summary of this particular document, they recognize this issue and point to a limited number of practices where they find that definitive link. One-on-one tutoring, as we mentioned, class size reductions in the early grades. They also point out life skills training for junior high school students, anti-smoking programs, and early instruction to early readers in phonemic awareness and phonics as programs as well. The two that Chalkboard moved forward with, one-on-one tutoring and class size reductions in K-1, stand out in that they are very resource-intensive, as opposed to the life skills training and the instructional programs where individual districts could review that research and within their budgets pick up those practices as they saw that. They don't have that same ability easily with something like one-on-one tutoring and K-1 class size reduction. So, again, just a clarification there on Chalkboard's view of what they viewed to be a best practice or rigorous evidence-based research versus more promising practices. With that, I will turn to an introductory testimony on House Bill 2615, and I guess in my view, this encapsulates a lot of the spirit of the Chalkboard effort as a whole. It touches upon bills that they have already introduced, 2613 and 2612. The origins of this bill date back to the Finance and Accountability Work Group that Chalkboard convened during 2005 and early 2006. And it was in that work group that the team there essentially built what they saw as a promising fiscal structure going forward. And it is evidenced by this figure. I believe you all have copies of it. Where we started was to say, if we pick a particular school year, and in this case the school year is 2006-07, so a level of service in 2006-07, and then look forward, how would we how would we start to construct what is needed, given the evidence that we have and given what we know about what's going on in the schools today, to build a reasonable financial and stable financial framework going forward. The first step of that is characterized by the blue line, and that is the forecast of what that work group believed was needed to keep the 2006-07 current service level in place, with no changes or no implementation of efficiencies. That is constructed as follows, and the estimates here you can see on the left-hand side, we estimate as current expenditures per fall enrollee. So those are the this is the same definition that's used nationally, so we can always stay in touch to where we stand relative to other states, and we think that's important, that these estimates be done holistically, considering all the revenues that are available to the system, federal, local, and state revenues. The forecast is, at its heart, relatively simple. It's we looked at expected enrollment growth going forward, and over the course of this forecast period, the school-age children are not expected to grow as fast as they are or as fast as they did in the 1990s. We are the baby boom. Children of the baby boom generation moved through the K-12 system through much of the 90s. They are now making their way through the higher education system. But in their wake, not as fast growth for children expected, at least by the Department of Administrative Services and others. So that enrollment forecast is obviously key to this process. Then we step back and we took a look at per student spending. So how much are you spending per student? And in a broad sense, education is a relatively straightforward activity to forecast. About 80% of it is the salaries and benefits of the labor that's being provided, and has been that way for some time. And the other 20% are supplies and purchased services. So we broke down those pieces within that blue line, and we said, okay, now for that share that is salaries and benefits, what is a reasonable index going forward? And Chalkboard ultimately landed at looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics at a national index on compensation in the private sector for professionals and other related occupations. Now, K-12 teachers are within that category. Professors are within that category. Architects, accountants, and the like are within that larger BLS category. What is attractive about stepping out of Oregon to go for an index is that unlike the current process in the School Revenue Forecast Committee, where the committee essentially looks back at historic growth within Oregon, within the K-12 sector, and then projects it forward, this takes an objective measure and basically says that Oregon's professionals within the K-12 sector will do as well, but no better, than professionals across the United States. By contrast, the problem that we saw within the current forecasting method is that if you do have a policy problem within Oregon, like PERS in the early part of this decade, those policy issues are simply forecasted into the future, and there is you then lose the relationship to the private sector. And so choosing an objective, national, and appropriate occupation, and we see the professional and related services as that best candidate, gives us an objective forecast going forward. The other 20% of the per student piece, the purchase services, and supplies would be forecast with a price index, much as the state already forecasts with a GDP deflator that the state moves forward with. So that produced the blue line going forward, and you can see the increased spending associated with that. Then the second step was to back out the efficiencies that work group had identified in the three key areas from House Bill 2613. Those being savings associated with the implementation of an improved transportation finance system, of the gradual phasing out of permanent early retirement programs and of the implementation of the mandatory performance audits over time. By as you can see, just looking at the chart, those efficiencies really don't take hold until about 2011-12. We were very pessimistic that you would achieve savings very quickly. So there's virtually nothing assumed there in the early years. And then ultimately by 2014-15, that generates a 2% reduction in the baseline. And that's in essence written, or very explicitly written, into the bill, the expectation that there would be a 2% savings associated with the implementation of those efficiency measures. Then finally, the third step is to add back. So you're taking away and then adding back the investments associated with House Bill 2612, the achievement grants. And so that is at first allowing the funding of the one-on-one tutoring and the K-1 class size reductions, and then in the out years has provided some resources for yet to be identified improvements in middle schools and high schools as better practice and better research are made available in those areas. So that is the construction as envisioned by the Finance and Accountability Work Group in terms of the mechanics and how this bill would be implemented. The notion here is that the School Revenue Forecast Committee, which already exists under executive order, is a perfectly capable, objective source to be doing that. We heard no objections to that group doing this work. We're simply asking them to do it a little bit differently than they do it now. The reason that they are created in this bill is that they don't actually exist in statute, and so this would put them into statute. And so that's the reason for explicitly doing that. Then, of course, this is a statutory, not a constitutional measure. So it has a different degree of enforcement, in essence. Constitutional would provide you additional assurances that your forecast is held to by the legislature. But what at the end of this bill, the intent here is to put these forecasts in as many places as possible and into the governor's budget, into the beginning of the Ways and Means review process, and directs the Oregon Department of Education to distribute estimates, state school fund estimates based on these forecasts to individual districts, so they would begin budgeting for those at the beginning of their school years, so that if the legislature it did back away from it, it would be a relatively high-profile position to have to do so, because it would be these estimates would be used in a variety of different places. There is a circuit breaker of sorts, and the legislature could step away from that process during fiscal downturns if they had drawn down the Education Stability Fund. Very briefly, I'm not going to go into great detail here, but some of the subsequent pages in that handout show you the growth rates. For example, the next page shows the efficient baseline, and again, this is characterized as current expenditures per fall enrollee, going from 2006-07 to 2014-15, so you can see how much is spent per student assumed under the efficient baseline with the efficiencies taken out, and then the additions for the early age initiatives for teacher quality and performance audit spending, and then the all-day K middle and high school reforms in the out years. And then that generates a total per students, per fall enrollee spending total for each of those years. On the next page,
John, we have a question.
Okay.
Representative Minnis.
Could you tell me how many recommended student instructional days are assumed in this?
Again, Representative Minnis, it's the 2006-07 baseline that was built, that this was built from, so it would be the same as 2006-07.
Okay.
You know what that is?
I believe it's an hours mandate, not a days mandate, and it varies by level.
240.
I'm sorry?
go ahead.
I think it's 240 hours for high school, and then it's actually, we have some people here who would know that, but each one is slightly different, the total number of hours, and you can arrange the days.
It's 900. Oh, it's 900.
I'm 240. I got that.
990 hours.
Thank you. I knew there was somebody else that was with me on that one. 990 hours for the high school. Remember what the middle school is? I don't either.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, about 900.
On this chart,
goes back to credits.
The expenditure estimates under this plan are shown in the top panel under expenditures. Now we're, instead of characterizing these as per enrollee spending, this is now shown in millions of dollars. So we're starting at, and again, this is an estimate of total federal, local, and state spending. So these are not numbers that you are. These are not going to translate directly into the $6 billion or $6.2 that you're used to working with. But in any event, these are annual numbers for the K-12 enterprise, starting at $5.1 billion, rising to a little bit over $7 billion, looking at the total package. Then below that, we have taken some alternative revenue projections to see if these work within the revenue confines.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you.
Shannon.
Just a quick question. You've had to make some assumption to get to this chart about number of students, correct?
Correct.
And how did you make that assumption?
We looked at a variety of sources. The Oregon Department of Education has a forecast. The Oregon Department of Administrative Services has forecasts of school-aged children, and we looked at both, and then they're not far from one another, and adopted our own estimate, which is very close to both of those methodologies. It's about 0.4% a year.
Thanks.
So in these comparisons here, at the top, again, you have the expenditures. In the second panel, we're looking at revenue alternatives, and these are revenues that would be generated under these three different assumptions, but the revenues are all operational revenues. So they include federal dollars, they include local dollars, and they include state school fund dollars under these various assumptions. So the first one is, what if the state school fund continued to receive a constant share of the general fund, the same share that it received in the last biennium? Mm-hmm. Under the forecast, we estimate that given expectations on federal revenue, local revenue growth, and that assumption of constant share, you would get the growth in revenue going forward from 5.3 billion to 7.4 over that period. The next one is a declining share general fund forecast. There we were somewhat more pessimistic that K-12 could hold on to its share of the general fund, in particular given the expected growth in the Medicaid program going forward. But even with that assumption, we still end up at about $7 billion in the out year. And then finally, we modeled the governor's plan explicitly as introduced by the governor. And that one, for operational expenditures, ends up at about $7.2 billion in 2014-15. So under all three of those revenue alternatives, the chalkboard spending proposal is funded. Now, the main assumption here that, or the main driving assumption underlying this, is that the economy continues to hold, and hence the advocacy for the larger stability fund and the circuit breaker that we have in this language. This table simply summarizes fall enrollment, current expenditures per fall enrollee, and total current expenditures. And again, current expenditures are sort of the ongoing operation and maintenance of the schools. It does not include capital expenditures, which fluctuate much from time to time. And this bill does not explicitly address the capital side. So you can see during the 1990s, fall enrollment increased at about 0.8 of 1%. Again, the baby boomers were moving through that, or children of the baby boomers moving through the system during that period. current expenditures per fall enrollee, growing at about 3.5% a year, and so total current expenditures growing at 4.3% a year. Going forward under this proposal, you can see we get a bit of a demographic breather. Fall enrollment expected to grow at 0.4%. Current expenditures per fall enrollee accelerating 4.1% a year, so that's higher than in the 1990s and reflects the fact that on balance, Chalkboard is proposing an acceleration by adding the K-1 class size reductions, the tutors, and ultimately the middle and high school reforms. And so you end up with current expenditures in millions growing at 4.6% a year. And I believe I will stop there and take questions if there are.
Go ahead, Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Combs. How did you take into account the growth in categories such as special needs students? So if you look over the past decade, one of the major cost drivers in education has been growth in the number of ESL students, those with special ed students. How did you account for that in your projections forward?
There is no explicit drill down within this forecast for special needs populations. I would say that in special education, there has been a significant increase both in the per student spending on an individual student with special physical or mental disabilities, and there has also been an increase in the number of children identified as having those disabilities. It is unclear whether that particular trend is going to be as strong in the next 10 years as it was in the last 10 years.
A follow-up?
Yes, sir.
So just to clarify then, this assumes that the number of special needs students and the cost of educating those special needs students is fixed at the 2006-2007 baseline.
Representative Cannon, that is correct. And I would certainly say that Chalkboard would be open to investigating and pushing down harder on that particular assumption. But I would say at this point in time, there, as you have correctly identified, there has been a tremendous increase both in the number of students and the amount that we're spending on students, but I would say there has not been a corresponding attempt to understand how well we are running those programs. For example, in English as a second language, I am unaware of good routinely reported data that would show how many students are entering that status in a district, how long they are there, what happens to their English skills while they are in the program, and how many exit that status over a period of time. Not that individual districts may not have them. I have not seen them routinely reported and certainly not presented to the legislature. I would say the same issue around special education. I would characterize the 1990s in essence as having in Oregon and other places implemented federal policy that was enacted in the late 1970s. That the 1990s sort of finally caught up, and there has been a very sizable expansion both in identification and in spending per student in that area. I think at this point in time there needs to be some serious investigation around those programs. We did some within the Chalkboard program or the Chalkboard research project, and Dave Conley in particular looked very hard at that area, but couldn't come out with clear recommendations at that point in time on where to go forward, whether we needed to spend more money per student, whether we needed to be identifying more students in that category or not.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Dahlem.
Yes, you talked about the public law for special ed being implemented in the 70s and finally coming to full fruit in the 90s. Did you see a trend? We know that there's more participants, and we know that the severity of educational disadvantages is more. Is there a trend coming? Is this? Are we going to continue to grow, or have we leveled off just now that we have the law fully implemented?
Representative Dullum, I would certainly not characterize special education as having necessarily having leveled off, because I don't believe it is not a fully mature program. I think there's an awful lot more that has to be learned. I believe it is the expectation of the Department of Education and actually in the quality education model itself, at least for students with physical and mental disabilities, that the growth in the number of students that are identified under those categories are not going to grow at the same rates as they did in the 1990s.
Thank you.
Representative Buckley, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Just basically, going to make sure I'm clear on the what this is all based on. So this would require the efficiencies projected by Chalkboard to actually come through at approximately $200 per student?
Representative Buckley, House Bill 2615 makes an explicit assumption that there will be savings, and there are specific percentage reductions assumed in the bill on page 3, I believe.
Yes.
Those are then immediately followed by increases associated with the achievement grant. So it's on balance an increase.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other requirement would be an anticipation that the federal government will at least maintain something close to what it's projected to be now. Is that correct?
Representative Buckley, the purpose of having built this guarantee around the entire current expenditure per fall enrollee gets precisely to your point, and that is that we believe the School Revenue Forecast Committee has to pay a close eye to where the federal government is headed with education, given that the expectation of most analysts that were on that finance and accountability workforce, the federal government is not going to be able to maintain spending in discretionary non-defense programs. And so our forecast, implicit in this, was that the federal revenue would grow at only about 2% a year, which is below inflation and below the overall cost of this program. So implicit in this assumption is that the state is going to be picking up a larger share of this program over time.
I'm glad we're making that assumption. And if I could just do one follow on that, I wasn't here. My apologies last Thursday. And if Mr. Wise already commented on this, when he appeared before us, he talked about a new way of budgeting, a new way of looking at budgeting. Was he referring to the same thing that these bills are referring to, or are we going to have a separate? Not to answer this, but when he talked about the Oregon Business Council and their approach and their recommendations mm-hmm. on education funding, we are going to get a presentation on that in the near future. So,
Chair Representative Buckley, they are very complimentary, and we've been working together in that process, and Chalkboard's been helping support the facilitation of that process. The one difference is they're looking at the continuum, and we took on K-12, which isn't to say we don't support looking at the continuum. We just had that as our focus from the get-go, and that's the conversation we had with Oregonians, so we could see extension to that, but I think they pretty much fit very nicely together.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnitz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, for my clarification, the committee's clarification, if you look at your chart there and you look at 06-07, the $8.7 billion, that includes the special education money, correct?
Representative Wisnett, the 06-07 total there, we have fall enrollment of 563,400 students. The 8,773 is our estimate of the amount of spending per fall enrollee. So it's a per student spending amount, and then the
including
special education spending. Yeah. Yes, and then the total current expenditures are $4.9 billion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, follow on. So I want the committee to realize that's built in, and if your statement is you're making a statement that you think there'll be a decline in the need of special education, that's going to be even. More funds hopefully available. And I guess we also, one of the things, because I think we're getting closer with autism, which has been one of the biggest new requirements for special ed students, I believe.
Representative Wisnett, to clarify, I hope none of my comments suggested that we expect a decline in special education spending or in ESL spending. I would say that as far as I could go in terms of any type of certainty would be this, going forward, we will certainly expect an increase in the number of students needing English language assistance. That I think there's a near consensus around that, and that the growth rate in the number of students with special needs around mental and physical disabilities is likely to taper off relative to the growth rate in the 1990s. So it's not going to grow at the same rate as it did in the 1990s.
Thank you. Well, last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. In your first chart, you talked about your built-in a 3.7% increase in salaries and benefits, but only 2.8% in services and supplies. So is this, as we go in the out years, then the 80% of the education budget, which is salary and benefits, will continue to be a larger number, correct?
Implicitly, that is what's going on in that part of the forecast, yes.
Yeah, it wouldn't take many years to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm having trouble understanding something, and I think it's just the problem of my perception here. So help me out, please, John. you do have a chart that shows this green line, the line that 2615 is to, drawing close to full QEM. I don't think you showed us. Yes, there it is. It gets, well, much of the way there. I don't know what percentage of full QEM that represents. I guess that's my first question. In the 2014-15 school year?
I don't, Representative Cannon, I don't have that specific percentage.
It does appear to draw us closer, though. And then my question is, my follow-up question is, if we look at a different chart that you provided, the additional investments in early age initiatives, teacher quality, all-day kindergarten, middle, and high school investments represent about 6% above the efficient, as I did the napkin math, 6% above the efficient baseline. And I'm struggling to understand how only a 6% additional investment above the efficient baseline moves us from our 80% QEM where we are today, where we hope to be today, to the sort of maybe 90, 95% level that I thought this chart might have suggested. Am I just missing the point here?
Representative Cannon, I don't believe you're missing the point. There probably is some work that could be done between the numbers that we have presented here for the dashed line that represent the QEM are taken directly out of the December 06 QEM report and are they are listed as being the full cost of the QEM, including federal dollars. Now, the Quality Education Commission historically didn't have federal spending in the QEM at all. They were simply looking at the state and local pieces and impacts on the state school fund. And then recently have tried to build their prototypes to include Title I and federal spending. And so I guess the question that I'm still left with on the QEM, because these numbers are what they are, I took them directly from Brian Reeder at the Department of Education and then divided them by fall enrollment, is whether they do fully incorporate a comprehensive look at federal dollars and other sources that are available for current expenditures.
So if I can clarify then, in fact, you're suggesting this line representing full QEM may use a different measure of school funding than the, maybe looking at a different pie than the line representing the chalkboard efficiencies plus initiatives.
I can speak to the chalkboard line, and the chalkboard line has attempted to look at the full package of federal, local, and state funding. The quality education model, as it was reported in the December 2006 made the same claim, that it was the full cost of providing services.
Well, I appreciate your responses and appreciate your work on this, because this is, I've spent some time looking at similar kinds of numbers and developing floors, and it's tough stuff to do, especially years and years ahead. So thank you.
Can I just ask one clarifying question? I know there's several others here. So if I heard you right, John, one of these lines did not include the federal funds and the title funds, and yet the QE, the chalkboard blue line does. Now I got lost on which line includes what.
Sure, Con. Let me attempt to clarify. All of the chalkboard lines we have made the best attempt to look at current expenditures as defined by the National Center on Education Statistics.
Okay.
Including all operating revenues from regardless of source as defined by NCES. December 2006 QEM report reports a beginning number, 2007-08 number, and a 2014-15 number as the full cost of providing services under the QEM.
Right.
And I'm assuming, I know it has some federal in it. I guess as I look at it, my sense is there may be some additional revenues that are missing there. But,
okay.
But it is advertised as being inclusive or comprehensive.
Thank you. That was the clarification I needed. And I think Representative Roblin's next. Oh, unless, Sue, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to encourage you to look at this as a mechanism. You could make different assumptions about the efficiencies. You can make different assumptions about the investments. What we're trying to convey here is a different way of thinking about how you budget and estimate for districts. And I would just remind you where this came from. Again, a group of school finance folks, business folks, Brian Reeder types, where we said, we don't know what the outcome is. We're asking you, what's the very best?
I'm going to joke.
Idea.
Is that more than two people?
Ooh, ooh.
Well, no, he's 12 people.
He's so bright. Yes, and you've
here's
got
here.
The list. But I just want to make the point. Chalkboard doesn't have a vested interest here, and we didn't have a predetermined outcome. We said, how can we do this better? And this is the kind of mechanism that they encouraged us to take a look at. So it can be tweaked in lots of ways, as all of our bills can.
Sure.
I just want you to try to absorb it as a mechanism.
Thank you. That helps.
I was going to ask a question of Representative Cannon.
Okay.
When you were doing your 6% growth on the chart, that was per year, so 12% for biennium.
Let me look. Yes, I. Well,
because that.
No, because it's 6% each year,
time.
And so that
so it would show up
both numerator and denominator.
Which is quite a bit more than what we have done.
Right.
Over the past number of years, because we always get a percentage on the biennium budget, and you have to always divide it by two. So we've been averaging increases at about 3 and 4%. So it does catch up a little quicker.
Just to clarify, I was looking at the chart. It looks
right.
Like this. John, I don't know if you can get back to it. And I was looking at the 2014-2015 school year and computing how much of the total expenditures, recommended expenditures, their chalkboard initiatives represented. It was about 6% of the total, so I was taking that to mean that they were adding 6.6% to the baseline. And I think that's true of the biennium, too,
right.
Not 12%.
Representative Cannon, actually, that answer is in the bill. It's written into, on page 3, it's a 6.8% increase in 2014-15 to move from the blue line to the green line.
Thank you.
Somebody else, Representative Wisnett, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. John, if we can go to the bill and talk about the Section 6, but go back before Section 6, let me clarify. You're saying prior to September the 1st of each even number year, this Revenue Forecast Committee is going to do their thing. And then the next date is the governor when he does his budget report, which is, what, December, what is something like that. So, but you don't have any other dates to move this along. I would like to see some dates in there so we can move this forward. And then can you explain to me, the governor and the legislature may not, hopefully, and let's pray that doesn't happen, doesn't fund the amount projected because of recession or whatever, but they're going to draw down the Education Stability Fund. But they can't go any further than 25, and then there would be an impact on education. Again, so maybe a comment on the dates, why there were no dates as far as moving this. There's a lot of people in the building would like to see education funded earlier and help school boards and things like that. And am I reading right as far as the governor's going to have to make these tough decisions, but then we, he's going to give us a budget. The way I read this, he's giving us the number. The legislature has no other input in that other than if we have the recession. So we're taking the legislature out as far as, the normal thing we get, except maybe some optional packages or something like that, which we see all the time. Am I reading that correct?
Representative Wisnett, first with respect to the dates, we can certainly go back and look to see if there are a sufficient number of dates in the bill. We did work with Ledge Council to try to make sure this all mechanically worked correctly, but may have missed something, so we can go back and look at that. The with respect to the mechanics at the end of this, clearly there's a lot of work here that's done to create a number. And you go through and you forecast the federal, you forecast the local, and then you forecast the total and see what the state's piece is. Then the question is, how do you put this body's feet to the fire to fund that amount? And this bill stops short of a constitutional requirement, which increases the heat of the fire, but goes into the statutory approach. And what we attempted to do at the back end of this was to put this number in as many places as possible so that walking away from it would be a relatively high-profile exercise. It's in the governor's budget. It begins the Ways and Means process. Every district in the state is starting with the number and budgeting around it, so any movement away from it then generates however many stories in local newspapers about budget struggles that localities have. Now, with respect to its relationship to the Education Stability Fund, the point here being is that if that fund has been drawn down to, it's actually 0.25% of the previous year's general fund, apparently there's a small amount of money in that Education Stability Fund, and Ledge Council made us aware of this, that are in long-term investments, and it would be problematic if that amount were withdrawn. So that's why that particular percentage is written into there. But the notion would be that this body would go forward and fund this amount unless a recession had happened and that Education Stability Fund had been drawn down.
Okay. So again, the way it's being proposed is the decision by the legislature is being taken out, and even the governor, because of this committee, says that's what we're going to do. The governor should fund it at that, or does he have a? And he's because it doesn't. He says he can't fund it less than that.
Okay. Right. Representative Roblin might have the answer.
Not necessarily a response, but I think that what we're saying is that if you look on the chart that says current expenditures actual forecast, this one, basically what we are doing is putting into statute those falling the
numbers
per pupil expenditure each year. So that's what the budget gets built on. That's what it is. And we're saying, here's what it is. And a school superintendent could say, if I have this many kids in 10-11, I can look over here and say that I'm going to get $10,201, and I can build my budget on that because that's what we statutorily said. We're building this in and saying, what they have to do is come to budget to this number, which is how much we're spending per student. And that's the floor. There could be more if you wanted to put into it, but the floor says this is what they're going to get out through, in this particular chart, 14-15, but it really keeps going. I mean, there isn't any end to this the way it's written. There is a per-student funding bill that we're passing saying here's what you need to be giving each.
And that's equal to or greater than.
All the way along. That's how I read the bill.
Representative Roblin, Representative Wisnett, to comment on both of those at the same time. Again, I think Sue's point is the important one. It's almost as critical, or the interest here is to get a mechanism in place, a decision-making framework in place that generates on a number of different fronts forecasts that are different, more robust, more comprehensive than the ones that we have now, that focus on the entire, all the resources that are available to the endeavor, that recognize the cost of purchasing education professionals and their services through a compensation index as opposed to a price index, and there's a big difference between those two. And then to put as much profile on this estimate as is possible within statutory language. Again, the governor, legislature in the future always has the ability to go back into statute and make adjustments. They could leave the statute unchanged, fund a different level, and you end up with the high profile decision that I was describing. Alternatively, Chalkboard or OEA or anyone else could come back 3 years from now with the next best study on dropout prevention and say, you know, guys, you got it wrong back then in 2007. Part D that says 6.8% should now be 7.5% because we have this great new program called Check and Connect, and it costs this much, and you should fund it because it's proven, and we're going to reduce dropouts by X percent. So there's still flexibility within the statute.
I was going to say, we do have one more group that wants to testify. Are you okay, Representative Roland? Dahlem? Okay. Sue or John, any final comments? Because our time is slipping away.
Right, Madam Chair. Just if I might respond to Representative Buckley about the efficiencies we're assuming here. Again, just to remind you, we have a position on performance audits that's a little bit different than the bill you're going to see and that what you've heard about to date, which is we think all school districts need to be looked at, and we see it as a coaching best practices kind of process, but we do think when best practices are shared statewide, you're going to see some savings. And I think that's a key piece as you look at the efficiencies proposals from us. And I just want you to know that we are about to enter into a partnership with the Oregon Association of School Business Officials to do 5 audits around the state and to build a working model that we hope will bring you results by next fall and could be used as a template to do that through the Department of Ed.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As we're transitioning, we have Chuck Bennett signed up, Lori Wimmer Whalen, Tricia Smith, and Otto Schell. Do you have any idea how long you're going to take? Because Representative Roblin has a work group he wants to report on before we finish also.
We can make this as long as 12 if you want them.
Well, we have 12 minutes left.
I'll only take a moment.
I know. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. Thanks so much for putting up with us yet again on these bills. We're here in opposition to House Bill 2615 for a number of reasons, and I'll try to be as quick as possible and then respond to
we
questions.
We need more time. You know,
all right.
We can always do that.
Thank you so
on
much.
On another day, obviously.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Let me start with what we like. What we like about this is the idea of having a point below which future legislatures might not go. However, I also just heard that there is, I think it was called a circuit breaker, which said in times of recession, legislatures could, and of course you can't bind future legislatures constitutionally unless you constitutionalize the amendment. Therefore, it really is a paper tiger. Nonetheless, paper tiger or no, the idea of that is appealing, and we do support another speaker's proposal, which would place the floor at the 80% of QEM level and the ceiling at the full QEM level, which, by the way, just as an aside so that you all know, I was on the cost panel and previous biennium and also served my president, who was on the QEM for the most recent go-round, and have attended every meeting. And one of the things that most people don't realize is that $7.77 billion full funding level for the QEM for the 07-09 biennium does not contemplate a penny toward capital construction needs with respect to class size reduction, full-day kindergarten, or any of the other best practices that you will find in the quality education model. So even the QEM level funding to get 90%, not 100, not 99, as NCLB says, but 90% of students to standard, fails to fully anticipate the cost to school districts to do that. So that's just a fact that I'd like to make sure is on the record as you look at any proposal, ours or anyone else's. But what we our concerns are with respect to 2615 of these. First of all, we feel it reinvents the wheel. As you've heard, there is a school revenue forecast committee, and I've always thought that if it's not broken, you don't fix it. This is a group of not only advocates, but technical experts from DAS, LRO, LFO, the Department of Education, all of these folks who, by the way, if you brought them in to talk about what they do, what their assumptions are with their revenue forecast modeling, they might be able to tell you why they picked the numbers they picked, not the Bureau of Labor, but, in fact, using the database initiative that has every teacher and every teacher's salary, actual numbers, for the state of Oregon, and what the presumed roll-up will be. Their labor calculations, which incidentally go 3 years out, not six, good luck with that six-year forecasting, those numbers are based on real, actual jobs, not some kind of amorphous Bureau of Labor recommendation of all private sector salaries. So you are getting real data based on real your workforce that you have employed in Oregon. We think that's more accurate, but don't take my word for it. I would suggest humbly that you have those experts come in and tell you about the current revenue forecast committee that this bill seeks to replace, who's on it, why it was chosen, what they do, what data they use and why, and how they feel these changes would either add to or detract from the accuracy of the numbers that that current revenue forecast committee already prepares for you as you consider a roll-up.
Madam Chair, I believe, if I may, I just heard Ms. Hildick say the same people that serve on the current committee could serve on this. So you could, just to clarify that, I heard Sue say the same individuals that are serving on the QEM and doing school revenue forecasting could serve on this. So I don't think they're suggesting that we change the players or
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Minnis, that's absolutely true. That is similar. It's not identical, but it is similar. There are additional business committee members and so on theirs. But the assumptions on which they build their forecast are significantly different. For example, the CPI for services and supply is not the same as school inflation. We're a captive audience for textbooks, for example. There's nobody else that buys textbooks for our students other than schools. So the inflation rate there is more like 9% a year. There are things like that that are different, and they use a different approach for calculating school inflation that the CPI just hasn't been able to capture as accurately. Same thing with salaries. Focusing on the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimate of what people make out there is a controversial policy change, not a technical improvement in forecasting what the actual cost of your labor force will cost you in the coming two-year, four-year, six-year period. It's because we have the database initiative with those actual dollars in it, and what I'm saying is it's not the people, it's the process that I think you probably would benefit from hearing about from those technical experts, because they can certainly speak more accurately than I to the differences in the outcomes of those two different ways of looking at the numbers. That's all I was trying to suggest. We also think that there's a lot of top-down prescriptiveness, again, here in this bill, as with the other ones that it meshes with. We believe that it uses that the guarantee is too low. We think that it tries to forecast too far out, as I've mentioned, and that it uses ADM, not ADMW, which I think you've heard distorts the growth rate of specific subsets of students. The highest growth rate is, of course, the high-needs, low-incidence special ed kids, but ELL is catching up big time as our population of students for whom English is not their first language continues to grow. We're not capturing those growth pressures that also become cost pressures with any accuracy. Also, in the offset piece, I don't know how well you've looked at that particular section of the bill, but not only do they subtract their assumed deficiencies, which assume this, the passage of other bills, but they also offset local option dollars, PTA donations, bake sales, fees that you charge students for labs, any of those kinds of local dollars that come in, they take from the state total offset. Now, not every district has a local option levy, for example. So that's going to give you another statewide distortion if you are subtracting that from your total. It doesn't give you a revenue forecast report that is accurate. It gives you a distorted version of that that won't fit individual school districts, we think. And also, I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about future legislatures and past legislatures and assumptions that laws are built on. That local option law, I sat through those hundreds of hours of hearings, and there was a lot of conversation about why that those dollars would not be offset, what the local option levy was supposed to achieve over the basic educational support from the state. And you would be, if you adopted this bill, completely reversing all of the contemplations of the legislatures that came before you, which is, of course, your option to do. But I just thought you ought to know that there is a considerable record built on the reasons for doing that, and that this would be a very significant departure from those policy decisions of your contemporaries. Also, the dictates for building in the roll-up of the student achievement money doesn't consider whether or not that bill is actually going to pass. So it would essentially require the passages of two bills in one, kind of an armada type thing. We also wanted to make sure that you knew that. I think I covered that all right. I guess that's pretty much it. I would like to see that the facts of the School Revenue Forecast Committee's work of what exists now that you would be replacing be made part of your record if it's at all possible, or if it is your decision to have another hearing on this so that you could hear why they believe they've picked good assumptions for building the numbers. I would also like to know whether or not it's considered good economic practice to try to forecast 6 years out rather than three. I think we've had experience with that in other economic questions, and it's not worked out all that well for us. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, do you have your testimony in print for us today?
No, but I did bring something for you that is the quality education model data around what's been happening with the actual numbers as they have it. It's not the whole report. It's just three charts.
Okay,
I thought that
helpful.
You would find that useful. It talks about its assumptions and where the school funding has gone, state, federal, and local, and also the ratchet effect that would be eliminated with having a fixed starting point. That's the third chart, and I thought you would find that useful. As well.
Right.
I'd be happy to type up my notes, though, if you want them for your record after.
Well, it would be helpful, and however, we can support you with that. But as far as your questions about, I wrote down several about forecasting and expenditures and local options, and so I don't want to miss any of those pieces.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll just, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I'll also submit some written testimony. Just to boil down, school funding, this bill, any bill we would bring you that is statutory, ultimately the issues are a good economy and willing political leadership. This kind of statutory language can be overridden. We currently have constitutional language under ballot measure 1 that gets overridden. Ultimately, it is a question of the willingness of the leadership of this state to meet the needs of the children of the state of Oregon and their education. This bill doesn't change that. It doesn't provide 1 ounce more guarantee than anything else on the books. We might as well be perfectly happy with the existing situation, because this doesn't change it as a matter of policy. And we'll submit our other questions, concerns. But I think you've got to get right to the heart of this thing, and this doesn't change anything. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tricia Smith, representing Oregon School Employees Association. I will keep my comments very brief. I appreciate Ms. Wimmer-Whalen's being very concise and comprehensive in her remarks. We agree with them. I'd like to leave you with a couple of ideas regarding this bill. The first is that the purpose of the current School Revenue Forecast Committee is to provide the legislature with actual numbers of what it will cost to educate kids according to the plans you've set for the next 2 years. not to give you an unrealistic number that fits a plan that you may have to do it differently than it's being done. So if you want a number for a different kind of plan than it's being done, that's fine. That's important when you're considering those new plans, but I wouldn't call it a school revenue forecast committee. That committee needs to give you real data about what it costs to educate kids today, according to the rules that you've set for schools to do that. So I would suggest to you that changing what they look at won't change the actual cost of educating kids, but it will change how you look at your funding of that effort. And so we wouldn't suggest that you do that. I want to point out one piece of the bill that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the way that this bill changes how districts deal with their employees and the way that they handle education all around. This is another one of those bills that, to me, sets up you as the state school board. And one of the ways it does that is by directing districts to consider this artificial school revenue forecast committee's number when it is making local decisions on how to budget. In section 5, sub 2, it says the district shall use the amount calculated for the district under this section in preparation of the budget of the district and for other matters relating to expenditures of the district, including collective bargaining, contractual commitments, and program changes. So rather than local districts being responsible for the education of kids in those districts, you are taking the responsibility and you're directing districts in how to implement your policy, including right down to how they bargain with their employees. We think this is an extreme bill that moves you further beyond where you intend to go, at least according to the policy that's been of this body up till this point. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time to go.
Almost.
Okay.
I know the chair of the next committee.
You bet. My name is Otto Schell. I'm the vice president for legislation with the Oregon PTA. In the category of don't wish too hard because you might get what you wish for, in this bill there's no provision for parents to be listed as participants as one of the groups that's involved in the discussion. It comes up in a couple other bills, another bill that you have seen from Chalkboard. It's something to think about. It comes up particularly in the TAG world. The TAG parents are really boisterous about their need to talk about the issues that relate to their kids because they're so different. The other thing that I do is I carry around with me a little thing from the Oregon School Board administrators, and I'm reminded that 38% of the kids in Oregon are kids that come from, I want to use the right lingo here, low-income families. And I think that that's increasing. I think that the ELL, Hispanic population, shows on here increased 171%. I believe that that trend is continuing. The reason I raise that is it's not getting any cheaper to educate these kids, these groups of kids from poverty, the groups of kids from special needs. We have to get our heads wrapped around what that costs and not pretend that we can do it in a cheap fashion. And that's, I would like you to think about that as you consider this bill and many others. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Schell. Thank you, witnesses. I need to share that I do have to apologize. We had two other witnesses that we are really out of time today. And so if you want to talk to our committee staff about submitting your testimony, I do apologize because we are out of time because we have one last announcement.
Okay, I would just ask our committee to consider putting together a work group around the collaborative that we had on the last one, which is 14. And we did have a person from OEA and a person from Chalkboard meet, and I got a little summary, and I haven't got to say the whole thing. But from my perspective, there are an awful lot of places of agreement. There are other places that really need some more work. And I'm at the point where I believe we should have a bigger work group where we include other people, other organizations in that discussion. I have talked with the governor's office, and James Sager has agreed to be to help pull that together. I would love to serve, and I don't know if there's other people, and you can decide that, and to work with those, and would give them an opportunity to either talk to our office, I guess Nick at my office, and let them know if they want to be involved, and we'll try to get something convened to start having a more in-depth idea, because from my perspective, one of the things I think everybody that I've heard has agreed on is that there is a need for comprehensive staff development in our state. And that clearly came from that little group that got together. That was the biggest single statement that everybody agrees on. There might be a whole lot of other stuff that we have to work through about how we're going to organize it, but the reality is we have not done that. It's clearly in the models we looked at today, both of them, quality education model and others. It's a need, and it's there. So would love to get together with other groups and have a work group to come back with something that we can move forward.
And Representative Roblin, what was the House bill number?
That was 2614.
Okay. I will get back to you, and I forgot to close the public hearing on the other two bills.
So that was on the bill. That was one of the bills.
That was one of the bills? Okay, so I'm okay.
You're okay?
Okay.
You were in the right place.
I would go along with the representative's suggestion if between now and Thursday morning, before we have committee on Thursday, if people are indeed interested in participating in a work group, if you'd let Representative Roblin's staff know, and then we will get some direction from there and some organization then. Okay?
Agree with me.
Okay.
And if there's anybody else on the committee, just kind of...
Any other committee members, obviously.
Let me know if they're interested.
Okay. I'm going to close the work... Public hearing on House Bill 2615 and 2614.
Yeah.
And with that, I appreciate everybody's attention today. We're adjourned.
Thank you.